Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from Red Hat Summit, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open this hour to be a part of the program. It is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. That's 1-855-450-6624, or send an email to live@asknoahshow.com. My name is Noah Chalai. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah show kicks off this hour. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening. It's in Denver this year, is it not?
It is in Denver this year. It's been kind of... So, little backstory, Steve. They wanted to do it in California, and then a certain Cupertino company in California booked the event venue. So now we're in beautiful Colorado, which I'm actually not all that upset about. I think it's great. Very nice. Yeah. So it's been an absolutely fantastic time at Summit. There's, you know, I would say... For all of the corporate conferences, and there is absolutely a difference between like the community-focused conferences and the corporate-focused conferences, but I would say out of all of them, there is absolutely a difference between the ones like Red Hat puts on where, yes, it's corporate, yes, it has a big production, fancy flash appeal, however, comma, if you walk around, it's a bunch of nerd groups, right? It's the Fedora guys and the little nerd groups break out, and they're all still here. They're just dressed a little fancier, and we eat slightly better food, and the keynotes have fancier PowerPoint intros. Like this year, like the only way I can describe it, I think it's on YouTube, so you should go watch it, or everybody should go watch it. But effectively, it's like they had like a red hat that like danced, and it started out on the big LED wall, but then it like buzzed around the room. And I'm like, did they put LEDs all over the place, or how are they making that happen? And I don't know the answer to that question, Steve, but I'm still impressed by it. That was earlier. Actually, it was yesterday.
Did you like the keynote kickoff with the live band there? I thought they were pretty good, although yes. They got a tepid response from the audience.
Oh, no, really? I thought it was fantastic. In years past, they've had like a piano player. I think this year the featured player was some sort of string.
He's a violinist.
Violinist. Yeah, I was afraid of showing my string ignorance. But yeah, I think stuff like that is really cool. It is, I'll tell you this much, and I know you could probably speak to this at nauseam. It's so cool. Red Hat feels like the big brother of open source. You know what I mean? Like, I remember the days when I would go to conferences that were very proprietary in nature and I didn't have a choice. I mean, at the time I was working in the industry, that's where you went and that's where you learned, but it was just a soul sucking experience. You would show up at these places and people would be talking about the latest thing in Active Directory, or there was a debate between, did you want to host your mail on Lotus Notes, Domino, or Microsoft Exchange? And I would want to fall asleep just attending. And then you get here and everybody's telling me how, even if the rest of the industry was to do it in a proprietary way, Red Hat would be interested in doing it in an open source way because they're an open source first company, and so they want to push all of that, and they want to enable their partners to be able to leverage open source to its fullest potential and meet customers where they're at, but they want to do it with open source. And I asked Chris Wright, the CTO, I said, hey, can you tell me, as it relates to AI, because that's, you know, AI and ML is what everybody's talking about, you know, is there a point where you say, yeah, you know, sometimes the proprietary thing is a little bit better. In the case of modeling, it comes down to as the best trained model. And his answer to me was, no. I think the way he phrased it was, the more open source, the better. That's Red Hat's view of it. And I'm like, man, it's so cool to have a multi-billion-dollar company that's our big brother, and now we're not at the mercy of the Microsofts of the rest of the world. I don't know. I'm amped up, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So you said you're seeing a lot of nerds. How about we help some nerds of our own?
Oh my gosh, I couldn't tell you how excited I am to go help nerds. Our first email this week comes in from
Charlie.
Charlie writes in and says, "G'day everyone. Steve mentioned getting the Reolink cameras, and I found them quite good. For people on a budget and don't require PTZ, consider the following three models." And then he gives three models for PTZ. Now I want to stop right there and say, Steve, didn't you buy a PTZ model, and aren't you very happy with your PTZ model Reolink camera?
I am. I have three of them now. I believe why he's splitting hairs is because if you don't get the PTZ models, it's for people on a budget, because you get to knock off $50 off the price, for example.
okay. So he lists three different models. If you're not looking for PTZ, you can check those out. If you are looking for PTZ, I don't know why I said PTZ. You started it, now I'm saying it. PTZ, pan-tilt zoom. But you can check. Steve has some recommendations. I think we've got in either last week, the week before, the show notes. You can check those out. I'd highly recommend them. And I'll let you know a little secret. I was looking through some of the purchase history, and I came across some Reolink cameras, and I noticed Reolink cameras are my make good cameras. So it goes like this. We bid out a job. We tell them you should buy these Axis cameras, this, that, or the other. They do, they don't, whatever. And we get down the road and something happens and I have to give somebody a free camera. Doesn't happen often, but sometimes it happens. And it happened in a church where they had three cameras that we were supposed to quote out and we were supposed to replace. And you ever forget to do something? Happens to me all the time. We didn't do it. And so they came back and they're like, what about these three? And I'm like, you know what? Now they're on the house. And that has become the, we have to do a make good. Here you go. Because as you've discovered, they're just really solid cameras for the money. And so far as I can tell, there's no guarantee or anything. I'm not you know, attesting to their security, but I haven't found them to do any weird calling home like I have with what's the name of the brand? The ones that are made by the Chinese government. The name escapes me. But those are actually called, they're not just made by China. They're actively made by the Chinese government. They're terrible. Don't buy them. But you plug those into Wireshark and you can see them calling home and trying to do all sorts of funny business that, and don't have that problem with Reolink. So I think those are a really great choice. Charlie continues and says, the access point that had the SSID issue is on the same power circuit as the access camera. If so, I would recommend getting an electrician into the house and checking the circuits, the power leads, and considering some beefy shielded cabling over the stock standard house install. His house could have really old power cables for the electrical circuits. I'm not sure I'm following what he's saying. There's going to be power filtering in the PoE switch, is there not?
Yeah, I believe what he's thinking. I'm not sure, but I believe what he's thinking is that we've got some cross-communication between the circuits feeding the line and stuff like that. I'm not exactly sure, but to answer that question, the house is not even 30 years old yet, so it's not like it's got really old wiring to begin with, and they are not on the same segment. So my PoE stuff runs off of a dedicated line that I have just for my network switches, because why not? I had the extra breaker, so I put all my switches on the same breaker.
And above and beyond that, you've actually, even beyond what came with your house electrical wise, you've continued to improve that, haven't you? By way of CT clamps and rerunning electrical wire where necessary and redoing circuits where necessary.
Yep. And I also have a sub panel now. So because I got the solar put in, so now I've even broken out from the main panel. So just to fill in the whole picture, my network switches are on the original panel that came with the house. The PoE, like the actual area where the PoE access point is on the new sub panel that was put in. So they've already been split out from the main panel.
Charlie continues on and he says, has Steve considered using ESP32s with LoRa instead of Wi-Fi? And then he gives the band the band limitations and the FCC frequency bands. I really like LoRa. I haven't really had a chance to play with it in person. How about you, Steve? Would you consider using LoRa over Wi-Fi?
So I absolutely would. The challenge here is that the stuff that I have that is running on Wi-Fi are things like the GE sockets or things of that nature that probably don't have a LoRa compatible or a LoRa equivalent thing to switch out. Like, I'm not going to shove... So I would shove a PoE, like a Shelly device, in behind like a generic wall socket or outlet. I would absolutely not put one of my homemade ESP32 things behind there, right? And so a bunch of the stuff that I have is for individual monitoring at the socket. Or, for example, I have one on the projector that turns it on and off. I have one that turns on a space heater on and off depending on heat in the room and stuff like that. And so those sorts of things, I don't believe, are done via LoRa.
Mm. He continues on saying, have you seen the off-grid LoRa texting networks? They are gaining traction in the crap-hit-the-fan off-grid community. I've been seeing drones using LoRa Express and LRS instead of 2.5 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. One thing I found with Reolink cameras is they have an LA Express store. and check the Australia warehouse. It takes a while to order instead of from China or overseas. So LoRa, in from the standpoint of a communications protocol, is where I've most seen LoRa prominent. There, in fact, at the radio station that I work at, there was one of the other IT guys installed an antenna on our STL tower that communicated LoRa to send small bits of information back and forth from the transmitter site. So even if they lost internet, they had the ability to get information back, saying things, basic things like temperature reading, is the air conditioner on, is there things here, can you send some basic commands to turn this on or that off or restart this or that or the other. So as a communication system is where I've seen LoRa. That's where I think it has its largest promise. Especially in the way of censorship and oppressive regimes that want to prevent their citizens from communicating. That happens all over the world. Sadly, I'd have to say, to include even here in the U.S. in some cases. So the ability to have a radio, it's always kind of struck me as kind of weird, Steve, that back in the Palm OS days, back in the, if you remember this far, back in the Apple, I forget what they called, Alpha Smart days, they had little IR blasters, and you could aim one device at another device and tap a button and send a file from one device to the other. And so that device didn't require a network, didn't require an access point, didn't require a switch, didn't require a router, didn't require any of that. It was just, I have a device, you have a device, I have the means to transmit and receive, you have the means to transmit and receive, let's exchange some data. Somehow we've lost the ability to do that. Like, we have, there are certainly apps that try to do some of those things. There's certainly hardware devices you can connect to your phone to try and do some of those things. But by and large, if you walk up to somebody and you want to send a message to somebody, even if you're sitting a few feet away and you're within range of Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or BLE or NFC or whatever else, there doesn't exist a very universal or explicit way to say, hey, I just want to send information over to that person. That's where I think LoRa potentially has some real value, some real leverage.
Yeah, I like the long distance aspect of it too. And it's nice that it's on the 900 megahertz. We kind of are well documented as to talking about why that's advantageous.
Yeah, huge. Yeah, especially with more and more stuff going on to 2.4. Brandon writes in and says, "Hi, Noah and Steve. I'm in an awkward situation and I wanted some advice. I have a long-standing contract with a customer for programming. Over the years, I've pushed some IT initiatives because they had no other IT resource to work with. Recently, I put in a bid to extend my contract to do some general IT work for them, but it was rejected for conflict of interest, concerns they had with me doing the programming work as well as their IT work. While I disagree with their assessment, they've made it clear that they don't want to reconsider, so I've accepted their position. The problem is they keep asking me for IT advice. Today, they said that they wanted to set up a call with another organization they work with. The goal was to me being to help them with an IT initiative I implemented years ago. If I have experience with something, I generally like to help. But I think they're taking advantage of the situation, and I'm starting to feel like the conflict of interest is a real concern for my side of the fence. Have you ever run into this with one of your customers? Any idea how I can draw a line and say, I won't help with IT-related tasks without hurting the contract I have? Thanks, Brandon." Man, Steve, this is one of the more interesting, intriguing ones. I mean, this is the kind of thing that... this is the kind of nail biter that you need coffee for. What would you do if you woke up in Brandon's shoes?
So it's absolutely a tricky situation to be in. And so he asked, have we been in this situation? I have. I absolutely have, where you've got a client that's obviously trying to milk you for. So what will happen for me particularly is I'll roll off a client and then I'll continue to get emails. And I don't mind if it's like, hey, it takes me 5 minutes or whatever, or I can help redirect, or let me connect you with the right person. I really genuinely don't mind that. But when you start getting, I, for example, I had one client that would continue to invite me to meetings, and not just like the, I was on some list and, you know, I just got kept getting it because I was on the list, but like I would look and it was myself and two other people and, or things like that. And so there's always a fine line between keeping a healthy relationship with the client, but also putting in that line of respect. So one of the things that Noah and I have talked about a lot over the last, I don't know, 5-6 years is when you set up bounds of respect for yourself, the clients that you want to keep will respect you more because you have set the boundaries in the sand for them. And so how does this help you in your situation? What I would consider doing is I would not interact with them on a phone call. I would not do anything face to face. I want to be helpful. I don't want to be the vendor that's like, I did a thing and now I'm not going to help you, you know, continue on, right? Because we've all had those vendors where like they put in a switch, but they didn't give you the password for it, or they didn't tell you where that access point was hidden and you had to go spelunking to find it yourself. You don't want to be those people. I might consider writing down what I can remember. So I would do something like this. What are you trying to achieve? And I would have this written down, right? So don't get sucked into a conversation. You want them to write down what it is that they want and clearly define it for you and what their expectations from you are. And then I would do my best to sketch out for them, as you would if you were sitting in the room, what it was you remembered from that project. It's years ago. You know, this is what I recall. Here's the documents. You know, this is where you can find the information that I wrote. I don't know how it's evolved over the years, but this is what it was the last I remember. And then call it a day, right? To my belief, that is where your responsibility ends, if you felt that you had any, which was just simply lay out, like, this is what I remember of how it was. This is where I remember the documentation is. And that's it. Right? You're not taking on new responsibility, but you're also not being a stick in the mud and not trying to help them. But you don't want to be pulled in. What would you do, Noah?
So I had to think about this a little bit. I feel like I would start here. I would start by being a really, really good listener, right? So you get on the call. They say, hey, you know, we want you on this call with this other IT company. Okay, no problem. I'll be on the call. And I'm listening and I'm carefully taking notes of exactly what's being asked of me. And I'm taking careful notes of exactly what involvement they have. And if it's all informational, if it's all just the, you know, if it's the other IT company going, what's the IP scheme? What's the password to this? How is this set up? How is this routed here? How is traffic getting from over here? We looked at this, and that I would write off as exactly what Steve is saying. Documentation for previous work. Once you start getting into, or if I got any inclination of, well, how would you do this? How would you do that? How would you attack? That's where I would either turn the question around to them. Well, you're the IT company that you're looking at. How would you deal with that? I know how I would address it, but I would deal with that. And then I might privately go back to that person and I might write out, especially if it's somebody you've had a relationship with for a long time, I might redo that proposal and I might just go and have a cup of coffee with them or sit down in their office and say, listen, man, here's the thing. We've been working together for a long time. I feel like I have a pretty good idea of what happened, what goes on in the IT thing. There are other companies that are able to do this. If you only want to leverage me for my programming potential, that's perfectly fine. Here's my billable rate, but just understand that here's where I am useful to you in the way of, if you have a programming project, you want some development help, I'm going to help you. When you start getting into asking how I would, you know, deploy VLANs or do that, that's really not a place I'm going to be comfortable giving information, because you're not paying me or you don't want my input. You've made that very clear by saying that there's a conflict of interest. So if there's any room in your mind, or if there's any room in your organization to reconsider your there's a conflict of interest thing, I'm still very happy to provide you the IT services that you're looking for. Past that, I would default to what Steve says. Give them the information that you have for the work that you've done and let them figure out the rest. But I'll tell you this, kind of referencing a conversation that Steve was talking about earlier, you don't want the clients that you have to really fight for. It's okay to be, it's okay to show interest. It's okay to go out there and say, hey, I'm interested in serving you. I have a desire to serve you. I enjoy our relationship and I would like to expand it. That's okay. But anytime you feel like there's a reservation, let them walk, let them go someplace else. And 9 out of 10 times in my experience, when they go elsewhere or they go dipping around, they come back. So I used to pride myself, I might have even said this on the show back in the early days, I used to pride myself on the fact that we never lost a customer. Since 2009, we never lost a client. Once people switched to AltaSpeed Technologies, they never left, because we treated them so well, took such good care of them that they just didn't go anywhere. And I defined myself by that. And what I learned over the years, in no small part, thanks to Steve's wisdom and guidance and counseling, is I don't really want all those clients. I wanted the good ones, but there are some I was really okay saying no to. And that was a hard barrier to break. But once it did, what I found out, and I found this out rather quickly, within the next year or so, all of the clients that I had shed, I had replaced them with much better paying, much clients that are more up my alley and work that I really wanted to be doing. And I'm in a way better place today than I was back in 2017 when I would have told you, hey, yeah, for X amount of years, we just never lost a client. I wouldn't do that. So I would be okay with your walk away power to say, yeah, if you're not interested in me, that's okay. There's other fish in the sea for me to deal with. And if you think you can find yourself a better deal, knock yourself out. And then when they come back and start asking because it's not working out for them, that's where I would say, hey, you said it was conflict of interest. I don't want to be in conflict of any interest. So I have no interest in your network or in your IT thing. I'll stick to programming. Good luck with your network or IT thing since it's a conflict of interest. Our third email comes in from Charlie. Charlie writes in and says, G'day everyone, Proton Mail has let the privacy community down again. And then he links to an article talking about Proton Mail disclosing some user data to related to an arrest in Spain. And then he asks, is it to migrate over to MailFence or just host your own personal emails? I did notice that if you pay money to MailFence, they enable native SMTP POP3 support, or you can go with the Delta Chat app. Your thoughts? So, Steve, is it overstating to say that if you really need private and secure communication, email really shouldn't be the first choice to begin with?
No. I mean, generally speaking, the way that email works is everything that handles email along the way can and does take a copy. While there's usually a good faith time to live on those servers, there's nothing enforcing that. And so, by necessity, the way that the store and forward works in email, everybody takes a copy of it so that retransmissions can happen, so that, you know, better paths can be found, all of the rest of that sort of stuff, so that it can be stuck in a queue and eventually bounce around until it gets to its spot. So if you're actually, and remember, email is plain text. There's, unless you right. are GPG encrypting the actual body of the email, there's nothing to prevent people from just reading your email. So,
and now we're not using email anymore. Now we're using GPG and text documents, and we're using that over email. So I don't know. So here's the thing. So the first thing I want to point out, and it seems like every news agency either gets this wrong or they assume it wrong and then they get corrected by Proton Mail. Nobody has ever had the contents of their inbox compromised by Proton, including this case in Spain. Okay. That isn't what's happening. What's happening is other extraneous information that is tied to the Proton Mail account that is required by Swiss law because terrorism is illegal in Switzerland, that information is turned over to police, and that information is then used to identify the suspect. So, and we had Andy N on the last time something like this broke, and I think it was a climate protester in France. And I had him, and I asked him directly about it, and their answer was, listen, we don't intentionally expose anybody's data. We're very transparent about the requests that we respond to from law enforcement. But if you think that we live inside of a bubble in which you can just do anything on our platform and everything flies and there's no ramifications, that's a farce. That doesn't reflect reality. But if you look at this specific case that Charlie cites in Spain, the case was a person added their Apple account as a email not required to do. And even the article goes in and says, well, we tried to create an account and it required a recovery. No, it doesn't. You have two choices when you create a free Proton account. One is, yes, you can use another email as recovery email. But the second option is they'll give you a puzzle to solve. And then you solve like a CAPTCHA puzzle and you can create a free mail. I know because I have a whole bunch of them. So some of the misreporting kind of drives me nuts. If you sent an encrypted email from one Proton Mail account to another Proton Mail account, nobody but you has the keys. That's what Proton has promised from the beginning. That's what they've continued to deliver. That's what they've delivered in this guy's case because of other extraneous information. That is to say, he tied his Apple account to his Proton Mail account and they said, here's the recovery address listed. We can give you that information. That isn't encrypted. And then they go to Apple and say, who does this belong to? And of course, Apple doesn't care, give two rats behinds about your privacy. And so they're going to rat you out. So that's how this guy got caught. But at no point, and I cannot emphasize this enough, at no point is the contents of the email inside of the inbox where you have the private keys, has that been compromised? Never once. That, and that is what they promise, and nothing more. And they've been very clear about the fact that all of the other extraneous information, they may be compelled by law enforcement to turn it over. And, well, the Fourth Amendment and privacy advocates are not a shroud for illegal activity. What more can I say? Is that an accurate summation, Steve, from your perception? Or did you read this and go, man, I'm really kind of questioning my Proton subscription?
No, not at all. I mean, at some point, when you are a corporation and the government decides to lawfully, right, because this is not an unlawful seizure, they've gone and they followed the law according to the place that Proton Mail is incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
You have a choice as a business, like Lavamind shut down, but most places are not going to. And so I suppose that the broader question that people tend to forget is, okay, if they didn't do it, the thousands of other people, including myself, how would we feel if our email just disappeared because Proton Mail shuttered its doors?
Right.
They're business, and both my wife and I host our domains at Proton Mail. And if one day all of the email and related to that, all of the recovery stuff and 2FA and all of the rest of that just disappeared overnight because they decided to shut down instead of servicing, you know, one of 6,000 requests that they got last year. Yeah. How is that going to, like, which one is serving their customers better?
Mm-hmm. And the other side of it is, too, is I think that we have this fantasy that privacy and security is just I sign up for the right service and now I have it. And that's just not how any of this works, right? If you're thinking through, you know, really a great mental exercise to go through this is read Edward Snowden's book and watch the way that he approached operational security. And I think you can start to get an idea of, he assumed that every part of his chain was going to be compromised at one time. So it wasn't just he used encrypted email. He used encrypted email, but he used it on a burner laptop. It wasn't just encrypted email on a burner laptop, but it was encrypted email on a burner laptop that had a ephemeral operating system that he ran inside of his car, outside of a coffee shop, that was outside of the view of the security camera, connected to a guest Wi-Fi with a spoofed MAC address. So all along the way, if they compromised the email account, well, who did it belong to? I don't know. It came from this IP at this coffee shop. Okay, well, who was that? Okay, well, there's no security footage from the inside of the coffee shop. Who connected to this? Well, here's the MAC address. And then you're chasing a ghost at that point because he parked out outside the back and it was a number he made up out of his head. And so, I mean, even in that case, is there a possibility that the Starbucks, you know, sits across from Target and Target has security footage of his car and they can get a plate or what? I mean, to a degree, you have to take some of that responsibility onto yourself. You have to understand where the limitations of technology are, what it can do for you and what it can't do for you. And if you want the uber, uber secret, very, very non-identity tied, there are communications for that. As much as I'd like to promote Matrix, even Matrix doesn't fit here, right? Because Matrix is tied to a domain. A domain means that somebody is the registered ICANN owner. So there are ways to even look into those sorts of things. You'd have to go with something like, what's a good example? A simple X, right? There's a chat where you literally exchange two keys. You have a private key and a public key, and that's who that's the identity on the other side is a key pair. So good luck tracing that back to a person. And even that's not going to be foolproof because you could potentially track, you know, trace the network traffic as to who originated that message. But you need to think through those security, you know, that operational security and what applies to you and what doesn't apply to you. If you're going against, you know, you're protesting and you're going against your country, well, that's a much bigger deal than you're trying to get Bob three cubicles down not to, you know, email the dirty sweet nothings you're emailing your wife. Those are two very different threat vectors and they require two very different approaches. But I see way too much of this. Well, I signed up for this account, and then even the title of this article irritates me, right? They're throwing privacy people under the bus again. No, they're not. You just don't understand how the technology works or where the privacy and security options end and where you have to dig in and do a little bit of thinking.
On top of that, you'll note that they also contested several hundred of the requests that they received last year.
Yeah.
And while you might look at them and be like, well, that's not even 10%. I'm like, well, how much of the corporate resources should they tie up with legal expenses to defend every single one of these? So, like, they're obviously attempting to stand on principle and contest things that they feel like they have the strongest chance of winning.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Which is what the company should do. Pick the battles that you know you can win and then go win them for them. Matthew Miller, he is the Fedora Project Lead, a distinguished engineer, and a guest this hour on the Ask Noah Show. Matthew, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, always glad to talk to you.
I'm glad for you to be here. So tell me about Fedora 40. What has been the overall response?
Yeah, it's been good. It's actually been a little bit quieter than some of our releases, which honestly I feel like is good, because if I notice the reaction to a release, it's often because there's something that's gone wrong that I got to handle. So I think it's been very smooth. And actually, yeah, that's seeing uptake going up pretty high in my numbers. I didn't actually run them this week. I've been busy with this, but it seems like it's going very smoothly.
If you were to pick, I know it's like asking you to pick between your favorite children, but if you were to pick the favorite thing that you're most excited about for the release of Fedora 40, what would that be?
Honestly, it's how smoothly it went. We have a new person in a role that is called the Fedora Operations Architect, and her job is to kind of keep the schedule on track and look at how the operations are going in the project and optimize them and make them better. And so we have an on-time Fedora Linux 40 release again, which is it's historic, because there was a while in the project where on-time releases, it was kind of a running joke. Fedora's late again, of course, but I think we get back to the expectation of on-time releases, and I'm really happy about that.
Kind of going off that logic there. So I understand that CentOS Stream now forks from Fedora is it 6 months?
Every 3 years is that fork. Oh, okay. So Fedora Linux release every 6 months, and then there's also minor releases of RHEL every 6 months, and then in between there's the that's the kind of the idea of the CentOS Stream name. It's this midstream that always just keeps going between the two.
Sure.
But the CentOS, yeah, that branch is every 3 years. And yeah, so Fedora 40, Fedora Linux 40, let me keep my own branding straight, that is one of the branch points for a future RHEL. So
does that add any pressure to you and your team that, hey, you know, like, we're really hoping, Matthew, that this is going to make it into the release of Fedora 40, or this is going to make it into here because we'd like to see X, Y, and Z?
Actually, that's actually a really interesting thing this time, because I actually didn't see that very much. I think previously it kind of had been a big scramble with, yeah, a lot of Red Hat engineers being really pressured to get things in maybe when they weren't quite ready, and Fedora being like, this isn't quite ready, and all that kind of can cause a little bit of attention and just a huge scramble of, like, suddenly people are waiting to the last minute to get all their work landed. But I think this time, like, it was as I said, a smooth release, and we had a lot of changes, but not anything that really felt last minute or rushed like that or pushed to get in. So I think, back in the years before, RHEL used to kind of come out at a random time as well, with, you know, 5 years, 7 years, whatever between release. And so mm-hmm. going to this, again, with the CentOS Stream model, with this 3 year cadence there, I think the whole process that Red Hat uses is becoming a lot more just functional and running more smoothly. And so we didn't really have that big panic this time around. So I think that's nice.
Can you talk a little bit about the XZ vulnerability that came out? And specifically, was there an impact to you and the Fedora team, and or was there an impact upstream from some of the other projects that you work with? What's kind of been that discussion? What does that look like?
Yeah, wow. That's, you know, this is something that we've always worried about. It's a very advanced, persistent attack by someone, you know, well-funded, probably nation-state actor, to infiltrate a project and, you know, influence the maintainer and sneak in a backdoor. And so, it proved something that a lot of us have believed is out there, but haven't really, you know, seen at this scale. It went from theory to real there, which is kind of a wake-up call for a lot of people. In Fedora, so we had a vulnerable package in updates testing for a little bit. And so if you had the beta during the right particular days, you may have gotten the vulnerable package, although there's no indication that anything was actually triggered or anything, but that malware was, you know, was in our channels there. And it was really almost by luck that we caught it. But it is also kind of the kind of luck that we make in open source, because we expose this, you know, to so many people. You know, that worked out, but it was a close call. It really could have gone past. And there's maybe some indications that they were rushed at the last minute, and they hadn't been rushed, then maybe we would have been in more trouble there. And that could have been very serious. So we're looking at some of the things we can do, just kind of tighten up our infrastructure in general. And we're working on rebuilding, you know, Fedora security team as an active group that is kind of proactively looking for these kind of things and how we can make it harder to slip them in. But I think a lot of the thing that happened here is, you know, this was a small project with really one maintainer and one, you know, who has had a life doing other things, and they really put a lot of personal pressure on him. And so some of what we need to do is really like look out for each other in the community more. And, and you know, when there are little small projects that can need help, like pay attention to them and don't just take for granted who's working on those things. I think there, you know, because it was somebody who was a made up name on the internet, as far as we know, there's a big risk that we take this as a call to trust people less. And, you know, it's a scary world, but really open source runs on trust, and it runs on, you know, we community people working together to build something. And I think that if we become really paranoid and you start crying, you know, government issued ID with your government name on it to be part of a project, that would be really detrimental for a lot of reasons. But just that basic trust, extending basic trust to people, like that's something we need to keep doing. So we need to figure out how we can make it hard to do this kind of attack in a way that doesn't damage what we do to build software together.
Isn't part of, so putting aside the fact that there was no government ID, that there was no verified identity, that there wasn't any know your customer right, none of that. And even still, the community was still able to go suss out, here's the history, here's the first time it was committed, here's when this person took over, here's... We're able to tell all of that because everything was developed out in the open. Isn't that kind of a success story from the standpoint of trust?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, for the adversaries learn this time that next time they do this, they're going to have to make sure this person has their identity, has a social media profile and all that, which they can probably afford to do. But, you know, by this, we've raised the bar for what they need to do for an attack, for sure. But, yeah, I think... You know, it is something that we've cared about for a long time in Fedora, in you know, software development in general, and open source, that, you know, making sure we have a trace of things. And it's partly for a security thing, but, you know, there's another thing, which is we want to make sure people get credit for what they do as well. So we really like to, have that chain of attribution is important, and it kind of helps on a lot of things.
I can understand if you can't answer this question directly, but... With Fedora being kind of a in between before RHEL, and RHEL being obviously has a target on its back, you know, is that a potential target for some of these attackers to say, hey, you know, if we got this in, Fedora got it, went to CentOS Stream, eventually it'd make its way to Red Hat.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's why. So, you know, the maintainer of the package in Fedora was actually, you know, directly contacted by the person, you know, or whoever, person or persons, you know, pressuring them to do this update. They need to get this update in quickly because it has these things. And yeah, I'm sure that was because they wanted to get that into, you know, wide distribution. Absolutely.
Talk to me about the shift from mailing lists to Discord. So this is something you're seeing widely, right? It's not just a Red Hat thing. A lot of communities are doing this. They're making the transition. It's kind of the mailing list of the modern generation. How is that going? Is it being well received? If it's not being well received, why? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so I got to tell you my personal bias first, which is I love Discourse. I think it's great software, and the people who make it are amazing. It's an all open source project. You know, they have a nice company behind it, but it's open source, and they're really great to work with. So I'm happy about it, and we have lots of mailing lists in Fedora. It's an old project, and we have hundreds of mailing lists, although only like 30 are really active, but that's kind of a lot still. And I've seen for a long time that that's a barrier to entry for a lot of people in the project. So there's some people, you know, who love mailing lists. They come from kind of that world, that culture, mailing list culture that I'm going to go ahead and say used to exist pretty widely and is now a lot more narrow. And there are people who are new come to it who are like, oh yeah, this is, I love this way of working. And so that's real and powerful that like that exists there. But, you know, like I've got teenage kids and, you know, they, email is not a way that they interact with people. It's a way you do, you know, maybe occasional, like you get company business exchange things, but it's not a like a living medium for interaction. And I think that's really true of most people in the world coming into the world today. You know, people are used to different modes of that. And I also think that there was a period when if you tried to look at like what's going on in Fedora, unless you knew to look for the mailing lists, like it really looked like the project wasn't doing much because it's kind of buried underneath what's, you know, the web and social media and all the things that, you know, people see as active. Like it was just kind of an underground, that and, you know, IRC, which is their instant chat thing. Like people didn't see it. And so it makes that kind of becomes a self-fulfilling thing where it just is kind of things could have just kind of died off that way. So I feel like having, you know, a web-based discussion forum brings you kind of a new way of interacting, and there's like, you know, new tools. I, for one, love the reaction emojis to people's posts. It makes, you can give some feedback without having to like say plus one into everything and or me too. Like you can just, you know, say yeah on that without having to.
It's acknowledgement without tapping somebody on the shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, give me your attention one more time.
Right, and giving, okay. and also, you know, in that case, getting everybody else's attention, because if it's going out to, you know, 10,000 people on the mailing list, you know, five me twos takes 10,000 people's attention a little bit.
Yes, sir.
So I think that's really nice. And so Discourse does have mail, you know, notifications. It can be interacted with email, but it is really a web-first thing. So that's a change for people. And a lot of people, one of the things that's hard is people are kind of used to having this setup of, I have my mail, that's my hub for everything, and everything comes to me here, and I organize it there. And so with a Discourse world, it tends to be a little bit, I have to intentionally go to the Fedora space, or, you know, at least respond to the notifications. And that's kind of a change. I don't know. It would be kind of nice if there were a better like meta discourse thing for maybe, but not every discourse in the world, but like a bunch of open source things where you could kind of have a hub for that. I think that'd be kind of a neat project. Yeah, I think that like, so you know, everybody is like, here, this is where I'm going. You know, everybody across a lot of different open source things opens this up every day. And mm-hmm. that's kind of a home thing. For me, you know, I open up the Fedora, that there's a tab open with that all the time. And I think probably more people will get in the habit of doing that kind of thing, but it does have a, you know, risk of dispersing things more. So that's one of the challenges. But I really do think that it's the future. And I think mailing lists, not just the problem of, you know, like people's cultural norms around mailing lists, but email is increasingly a captured proprietary system, even though it used to be like the baseline, this is the most open communication things you have. You know, there's like seven big email providers. And if you want, I know this because I run my own mail server still because I'm a super geek, but like if you would like to make sure your mail keeps getting delivered to Gmail or whatever, like you've got to jump through a bunch of hoops. And maybe someday they'll be just like, yeah, no, sorry, it gets harder to just deliver mail. And so that's going to be more and more of a problem with mailing lists and those kind of things, and more of a burden on that side. That, I don't know. I think it's going to naturally happen.
Do you think going to things like Discourse makes the conversation more discoverable and more shareable? So, for example, if I didn't get the email, and I get it, that depending on what mailing list, some of them are public and you can go search and all the things, but I'm much more likely to hit a Google result and find information that just isn't a wall of text if it is posted online at all. And if it isn't, and I wasn't in on the mailing list and I just don't get access to that answer.
Yeah.
If it's a discussion happening on a forum that gives the Googles and the DuckDuckGoes and the search engine something to latch onto, does that make it more discoverable?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Sure. There's, you know, some be careful what you wish for in this. So one of the things that we moved this last year to having discussions on the discussion at Fedora Project Forum rather than on the mailing list is our change proposals, which is basically our process for if you want to do something big in the Linux distribution, there's kind of a process you go through to say, this is what I want to do, this is who it's going to impact. And then the Fesco, our engineering steering committee, approves or disapproves on that after community discussion. And I thought we could probably get more engagement on this because it tended to be, we would often have some that would get, you know, 100 mailing list thread, often with maybe the same handful of people going back and forth kind of a lot, but some okay discussion, but then a lot of the changes got no feedback whatsoever. And I thought, let's put this on the discussion forum instead and see, you know, if that, my theory was this will get more engagement. It happened that the first proposal was a fairly controversial one about adding some anonymized telemetry to the workstation, which that's a whole other topic we could spend an hour on. I think it was actually a pretty small proposal, but people are rightly concerned about their privacy and how, you know, operating systems, which is, you know, kind of the most like intimate experience with the computer, like it sees everything you do and owns everything you do. So people don't want your operating system telling on you. People are worried about that. So we had a lot of people showing up to tell us that this was a terrible idea. And I think that there are some cases like people who didn't understand our change process, that it is a proposal, that this is looking for feedback. And people are used to the thing where you say some game company makes a dumb decision, and the way you get them to change course is just pour out volume of fury so they can see everybody is so mad about this. And it doesn't matter what you say or how but you just like volume, noise. Mm-hmm. And so we got people coming in from social media, and that was the way they're trying to interact there. And that really kind of detracted from having a constructive conversation mm-hmm. around that, since then, our other changes have had a lot less of that, but there's still been some. There's a thing about KDE versus GNOME that got went pretty non-constructive after a while. Again, could people coming in and not really knowing what process they're coming into? So we may end up having to like restrict posting on some of those more controversial ones to people who've have a history in the project or something like that. I love to hear new contributors, new users, people who've been users for a while but never have weighed in. Like, I want their feedback on things, but it needs to be in, in this constructive vein of what we're going for in the proposal. So that's
with this being open and available and everybody can find it, how do you mediate those discussions? Because now everything is kind of happening out in the open, and there really isn't an opportunity to kind of shut those things down, or if you do shut them down, that also is a public action.
Yeah, so we have, there is a moderation team, and there's some stuff I actually need to work. Right now in the Fedora one, I am basically the benevolent dictator of the discourse. I try to get people's opinions on how to do it, but we don't really have a team around that, and that's not a sustainable long-term thing. So we need to build more of a team around that. But we do have a moderation team, and then the way discourse works, as people are active on the site, they get more and more privileges on the site. And people who have been there for a while and are active and engaged can hide posts and things like that. So we're pretty active with that. And occasionally we've had things that we've had to raise to a code of conduct committee, but usually just a kind of a quiet message of, hey, can you calm this down or whatever, has usually been effective. Sometimes we've had to go a little higher on that. But mostly people engage in good faith and are positive on it.
For people that want to get involved in Fedora, somebody's listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, man, that is such a cool project. What Matthew and his team is doing is just really incredible. I want to be a part of that. Where is the need?
Oh, there's so much need across everything. I mean, one of the areas, this being Red Hat Summit here, that it's got a lot of interest right now. We're working on bringing up our AI tooling things. So this is really just basic AI ML tools like PyTorch and things like that, making sure those work with hardware acceleration and all of that. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in that, we've got some really neat things going on there. We also have this another thing that I guess RHEL's doing, this with bootable containers, which is basically the successor to what we're doing with Silverblue, CoreOS, the IoT things, the OS tree-based things, where we're moving from a constructed out of packages model to here's a cohesive like in this case, it's like a container model. This is a set of packages that go together rather than, and so I would like to make that the primary way we ship things in Fedora Linux. And if people are excited around that, there's a lot of work around making that happen that people could get involved in. Those are technical things. There's actually, there's no end of technical things, but we also need help with documentation. With our design team is amazing. We have a community process for the wallpaper every release, and that's a really easy way to get involved. And it's always nice to have new people working on that. Some of the things like being on the moderation team, or just the helping people communicate with each other and helping connect different groups together. Like, those are some skills that, we don't always associate with open source projects, but those people skills, like, we need people who are interested in social media, talking to people about things, people who are enthusiastic about Linux and want to tell their friends and tell the campus about it. Like, there's a whole bunch of different areas where you can get involved in Fedora or another open source project that basically anything you're passionate about probably can apply. You podcasts?
Absolutely. I'm picking up. Yeah. Talk to me about Flock. Flock is back. Give me the history. What is Flock? How did it get started? How do people get involved?
Yeah, so Flock is Flock to Fedora. It's our contributor-focused annual conference. And it was, we used to have a conference called FUDCon, which is a geek joke. Fedora, it was not Fear, Uncertainty, Doubt, but rather Fedora User and Developer Conference. That had kind of evolved into sort of an informal bar camp style where you'd show up and pitch a talk and that. And it didn't feel like we were being very productive at those. So my predecessor in this job, which is 10 years ago or so now, Robin Bergeron, had the idea of, instead of having these smaller FUDCons around the world, mm-hmm. we have a central conference where we bring all the contributors together from wherever they are and work on what's our plan for the next year? What are mm-hmm. we doing? What's going on? And get everybody in touch. And that, thanks to Robin's work and some other people, it'd be a long list of names, but that really was successful. The conferences have been great and just really energizing it is a contributor focus. So it's people who are working on Fedora, although it doesn't have to be someone who has been there for long. It could be a new contributor or someone who's interested, but it is this focus on, building the Linux distribution, building the community. And I find it incredibly valuable to have that in-person touch point. I would do it twice a year if we could, mm-hmm. but even just once a year, that in-person connections make it so much easier to work the whole rest of the year. And I know it's not possible for everyone, but even when not everyone could be there, even people who can't make it or have restrictions and disabilities or other things that make it hard for them to come to an in-person conference, that connection point still, I think, brings everybody together, and we try to make it as inclusive as possible. That lets us throughout the year interact in a way that I think we couldn't if we never had those connections like that. So during COVID, we had Nest with Fedora instead of Flock. We'd come Nest in your own home. Those were really successful online conferences, and those, we actually managed to have that same kind of energy there. Mm-hmm. And I really like to be able to do both of these things. I'd like to do it twice a year. I would love if we had the bandwidth to do, and that's human bandwidth, not internet bandwidth, a Flock conference, in the summer and a virtual conference in January or something like that. So actually, if somebody likes to organize events, run those kind of things, there's an area we could use a lot more help with as well. We've got so those Nest events were very popular, and we had 1,000 people attending them, which is five times more than we get in person. So that's a pretty good reach. But I do just feel like the human connection of face-to-face is really hard to beat.
Talk to me about what kind of background a person would need to be on your team. What is the technical, Well, let me ask you this. What is the technical depth of your team currently? What does that look like? And what is the spread? I mean, are they all technical people, some technical people, very technical people, artsy people, marketing people? What does that look
like? Yeah, so I guess it kind of depends what you mean by my team. So as it happens, like my employment at Red Hat, I work in the Linux organization with some very technical people who work on, you know, building RHEL. Although most of my peers are actually managers and things rather than people who are doing technical work. Then my actual, so I am myself the manager of one person. It is Aoife, our operations architect I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's a very small team. We may grow that a little bit. And Aoife has good experience in open source, but you know, she doesn't come from a programming technical background. She worked at an airport for a while. She has, where she was a small airport, so she was kind of helping everything go there. And I feel like that was actually experience that applies very well to running an open source project. Mm-hmm. There are definitely places where we need deep technical knowledge, people who can build packages, code, and systems architecture kind of thing. But just like again, since this is Red Hat Summit, Red Hat as an analogy, Red Hat's something like 20,000 people, and of that, 6,000 are in the engineering org, and a lot of those 6,000 are, managers, and we have pretty technical managers at Red Hat generally, mm-hmm. but so maybe a quarter of the company is deeply technical engineering, and so like that's what a company, that's really what a big open source project needs too. We need those skills around, sales, even though we're not selling anything, just that outreach and listening to user needs and bringing them back. And we need project
management. So you are selling
something,
in a way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
maybe
right.
Not for money,
there's no money selling, but we want, there's ideas, right?
Yeah.
And we want to address users' problems. So like the skills of listening and bringing those in are important. Honestly, coordination, project management, listening to people, and being able to really hear people and figure out what they need and want, like that's really important at what I'm doing in this project. And I think you have to like I said, I've been doing this for 10 years rather than doing actual technical work. So you also have to learn to trust people on things that, I know that someone knows this technical area, and so I don't need to worry or second guess or go down into that. I think that's an important part of it, and that's a skill too, really. And I mean, it's something you can learn, but you take some practice to mm-hmm. be able to do that kind of thing. But because there's room, it's a big project, and so there's room for all different levels of where you are and that kind of skill or other kind of things. You could be completely new to everything, and we've got room. And hopefully, if you're interested in growing technical skills, it's a really good place to jump in with what you know and start figuring out other things, and people will help you learn. Or interested in in those communication things or design or anything else, we've got a lot of space for that.
One thing we're asking everybody this year, Matthew, what does open source mean to you? And what is your favorite thing about open source?
Yeah, so in Fedora, we've got our four foundations that are our mottos. They are friends, freedom, features, and first. Any of freedom is about open source freedom and features and first. Yeah, but to me, the friends foundation is really the most important thing, because to me, it's not really so much about the licensing, although the licenses and like that, all that legal stuff is an important enabler, but it is that we are building community, building the software as a community. This community built, we are working together on something that, Red Hat owns the Fedora trademarks. They pay me, thank you. But they don't really own Fedora in a meaningful way. Fedora owns itself. We own Fedora. And by contributing to Fedora, using Fedora, Fedora is yours. Mm. And that's incredibly powerful. And like I said earlier about the operating system really being like a very intimate part of your lives in a lot of ways, like that, I feel like it's important for people to have that ownership of their own life and experience and their software. And so that, to me, that's what open source is like. That's the most important thing about it, that it lets us, you don't have to be a coder to have that ownership. You don't have to program it. Like you can be a part of it because there's like, this is a thing that's made for everybody. So that's what it is to me. Yes.
Matthew Miller. He is the project lead for Fedora and a distinguished engineer at Red Hat. We appreciate the time, Matthew. We'll get you back on the program soon.
Thank you. I'd love to be back.
The music in our ears means we're out of time. I thank you for joining us. We record the show every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central. You can join us at AskNoahShow.com. Feeling left out? Head over to podcast.asknoahshow.com. There you'll find all of the articles and references we use to create the show, plus the entire back catalog. You want to keep to date up on the latest? Join us on X. I'm at Colonel Linux. He's at Linux Evans. The show at Ask Noah Show. We're back next Tuesday, 6 p.m. Central, asknoahshow.com. Have a good week.